Welcome to Feasting on Design. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. I know it's a bit of a topsy-turvy world that we're in right now with the way COVID-19 has disrupted our day-to-day lives. Whether you're now working from home, trying to find things to do to keep your kids busy, or lecturing your boomer parents about going to the YMCA to work out while the virus is still spreading, all of our lives have been disrupted. I hope this podcast can be an opportunity for you to take your mind off the never-ending news cycle. Let this be your opportunity to breathe, disconnect from the world and all of our social distancing, and tune in to turn off from the rest of the world, even if it's just for an hour. Give yourself a mental break from the stress that is out in the world right now. So before we officially start this episode, do me a favor and try to clear your head of any thoughts. And take a deep breath in through your nose. Hold it and count to four. One, two, three, four. And exhale through your mouth. Great. Isn't that a little bit better? Next time you're feeling overwhelmed or stressed out, just remember to take that deep breath. To hold it for a few seconds and exhale. It's a great way to reset your brain. So, are you ready to get this show on the road? Today on Feasting on Design, I'm talking with Nick Vanderwall, founder of Astute Graphics. We chat about how he went from a background in design engineering to building a business around graphic design tools, why businesses like Astute Graphics moving to a subscription model is a way that allows them to provide better services and innovate faster for their customers, the importance of continuing to learn, and why companies should offer training opportunities for their employees, plus a whole lot more. If you like the podcast and want to help support us, head over to patreon.com/feastingondesign. Every dollar helps us to cover hosting costs, upgrade equipment, and keep the podcast going. When you become a Feasting on Design patron, you'll get access to exciting Feasting on Design news before anyone else, plus stickers and t-shirts. So please, help support the podcast by becoming a patron over at patreon.com/feastingondesign. Nick, thanks for joining me this morning.
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me.
Great You're welcome. On. You're welcome. Our mutual friend Dave Clayton put us in touch, and as we were talking right before this, he knows everyone, so it's nice to have him be the matchmaker.
Oh yeah, as I mentioned to you, I call him the one degree of separation. If you don't know Dave Clayton, you're probably not in the industry or on planet Earth.
Yeah, he's great. Very true. So tell me a little bit about your background. How did you get your start?
Oh, well, I'm actually a design engineer. So I studied automotive design. Car design. Not the pretty side. That would be the glamorous bit. That's where all the glamour goes in car design. I was learning how to design the nuts and bolts of a car. So I had to study that uni. Got out.
That's what my dad did.
Hey! See? Yeah. And both of us, I'm sure, love the industry wholeheartedly.
Well, he ended up teaching after about 25 years in the industry. So,
oh, he was a proper teacher. Yeah, he knew what he was talking about then.
Yeah.
Oh wow, wow. Where did he teach? Out of interest,
At a technical college in Augusta, Georgia.
Oh wow, oh wow, that's fantastic. That is, because I know where all the automotive stuff in the UK is. It's one of my pet things, cars. So, you know, that's, but I'm not going to go on about that now. That's a different area completely. But yeah, it's an interesting industry, because I came out and I didn't design one car. There is not one car with one part of my name on it. Instead, I went to design what you'd call CATs, or we'd call JCBs in Europe. Those sort of, large sort of, vehicles of all different descriptions. And I designed a cab for one, something called a side loader. And I was very proud. I actually did end up designing one whole cab, and I have seen them running around still after all these years. And I'm a very old man now. So, I remember every single time I see him, the guy or the lady who's driving it looks really annoyed because when I designed it, it's a really narrow thing and they hate where they sit. And I thought, yeah, that's my legacy to the automotive industry. That's why I quit it.
Making people uncomfortable while driving. That's always fun.
Yeah, exactly. That was actually, I suppose, the start of the design side, or my interest in graphic design, because I suppose when I studied, I always liked the aesthetic side. Mm-hmm. And there is a separate side. I went to Coventry University, mm-hmm. which is in Britain the epicenter of the automotive industry. Okay. You've got people like Jaguar, or you say Jaguar, or whatever, or Steve Jobs used to say Jaguar all the time, and I cringe. And so all the car industry is around there, and I went there because I was either going to be an architect, mm-hmm. Or I was going to go into the aerospace, anything with motion in it, or an architect. So anyway, I went there. And I always liked the aesthetic side. So when I came out, I remember designing the first cab then for this industrial vehicle. And they let me do the whole thing, which is fantastic. So my first proposal was, and this is how it relates to every graphic designer, first proposal was, look, rather than a rectangle, why don't we design this massive swoopy thing with doors that are like hinges and, you know, inspired from Lamborghini and all, you know, all this excitement. They just looked at me and went, yeah, can we just have a rectangle, please? And I go, after 1 month of designing this thing.
Sounds about right.
So it teaches you, yeah, it's exactly the same as the design industry. You know, we can do this and this, and the client will turn around and go, yeah, very nice, but we like the old logo. Can we just keep that? And you just go, oh, yeah, okay. So it was like that. So I eventually went more and more into the technical illustration side, mm-hmm. and that became more graphic, and that's how I drifted slowly into graphic design.
Gotcha. How did Astute Graphics come to be?
Oh, I suppose the first graphic design thing I did was actually before I went to university. That was a long time ago now, think about it. So I was involved a bit on the side with computers, and computers became a bit more mainstream, not right at the start, I'm not that old. And these sort of computers came about, and
sure.
I got my hand on one, and I went, oh, that's nice. And I got more and more involved with it. And there was something in the UK called an Archimedes. Mm-hmm. Archimedes is a long forgotten name. It actually exists now as a company called ARM, ARM, you know, the chip maker. So they became ARM. So, you know, massive legacy in the end. But they made these British computers, sure. and it was used in the education system and used for TV and production and all that, a bit specialist. And there's this guy who I got to know, and he designed a 3D software, I think it was, yeah, 3D, called Euclid. I can't mm-hmm. remember the name. And I did some demos for this software when I was about 15 or 16. And I created these demos. And I remember the guy who designed the software, he went, I don't know how you created that design in my software. It isn't that sophisticated. It's not meant to do it like that. Because I created a whole suspension geometry of a car, something like that, you know, all the springs and everything.
Sure.
This is a computer with about, you know, 1K of RAM or a bit more, 4 mega of RAM or something. And I created all this with an animation, and I suppose it started there. So I started doing some graphic designs when I was 15 or 16 for other companies. You know, really on the side, you know, like £50 or $50, whatever on the side, you know, little things. Mm-hmm. I sort of forgot about it. Went to university, and then it became more the case that when I was at university, I had to do what you call a gap year. So that's when you go out for a year into the industry. Mm-hmm. And the first half year, I went to work for a company where I got an international patent being applied for in my first ever job in the first few weeks of my job. I was quite proud of that. It's a mechanical thing.
Sure.
And then after half a year, the company got taken over by an American company. I'm not holding that against you, Jason, or the other 350,000 people on your side. So got taken over and lost my job. So it didn't bother me. I was a gap year student. So I went back to university and said, look, job's gone. Doesn't matter. I'll do some graphic design on the side. I sort of enjoy that. Maybe do it on the side. And they said, no, if you don't get another proper engineering job for the other half year, you're off the course. So anyway, had no choice. But that sort of rekindled my interest somehow in the background. And then that Astute Graphics name came back.
Sure.
So the word Astute Graphics, a bit, I had a look at yours because Ildis is an interesting one. Mm-hmm. That's got a very clever background.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
If you don't know what it is, folks,
it took us like a year and a half to come up with that. So.
And one which isn't taken all over the internet, I presume.
No,
that's the hard
no,
bit,
it is not. Yeah, that was a big selling point.
Oh yeah, no, you did it cleverly. When I was 15, I just sat at home, looked on my desk, and went, "Oh, if there's a radio controlled car called an Astute, that'll do." And that was my thought process. And that's what was stuck. So I think we showed a picture of that actually a year ago, because not many people knew about that. And so there's this company called Tamiya in Japan that made these beautiful radio controlled cars. And this thing was astute. So Astute Graphics, I used it back then. Sort of did Astute Graphics stuff then as a freelancer. So I did graphic design stuff. Immense poverty by doing that. It was basically my very kind wife who sustained us for like a couple of years while I pretended to work in a dressing gown until midday and all that sort of thing. Like many graphic designers, unfortunately. And then sort of had to get a proper job. This is a very long story short.
Sure.
Did some software. So got involved in the software. Started up a software company for that aforementioned Archimedes or RISC OS computer system, which then went bang. So that stopped that company pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And then got a proper job again and then sort of started doing this plugin. So the plugin for Adobe Illustrator started because I was then working in an aerospace company when I was about, I think, about 30 or something like that. And I was the only graphic designer in an aerospace, not a massive one. It was only an aerospace company, about 250 people.
Sure.
A fairly local one. And I was left alone, literally left alone in this end of a room, a beautiful old country house. And I was at a desk, and sometimes there'd be deer running by in the garden, and sort of magical place in a way. And the marketing manager came along one day and said, oh, I need some show posters. And, you know, as a graphic designer, you launch into it. You spend 3 months on show posters, the whole lot. Mm-hmm. Pictures of planes, helicopters, survival equipment, which was their thing, and all these wonderful things. 3 months of design. And I had to use Adobe Illustrator, which I hated. you will not believe the hate I had for Adobe Illustrator. Unintuitive, just backward in every way in my mind. I slowly started getting used to it. Mm-hmm. But there's one thing that came to me is that the marketing manager came back after 3 months and said, yeah, like the designs. You know, he didn't bother to take a look in between. Yeah, can you make it more blue? And then walked off again. The amount of words that came out of my mouth at that point are not there repeating. So, okay, I'll start all over again, then redoing all this artwork.
I'm sure they were a lot of four-letter words.
Yes, like love and thank. It was five-letter. I can't count. he walked off and I went, that's ridiculous. How can I not make this design in Adobe Illustrator more blue? Why isn't there, it is in Photoshop, there's a more blue button. You can change the hue, saturation, blah, blah, blah. Why isn't it in Illustrator? What the heck? You know? It's been around for long enough, this program. And that then made me think, no. This can be done better. And then I realized Illustrator was made of plugins itself. Mm-hmm. And then I found out that somebody could make this for me. And then I actually plowed some of my own money into this sort of project, which was on the side. And then the snowball happened. So that is the longest story short I can give.
Sure. When you're building Astute Graphics in the form that it is now, and you're building these plugins, how do you determine what areas to go in? And is it just listening to, you know, Adobe customers' pain points and seeing what they're lacking and trying to fill in the gaps there?
Partly. I would say that's about 15% of it, being truthful. Mm-hmm. I mean, because I did do graphic design for several years and I work with people who have been either professional in pre-press or in graphic design, whatever. Mm-hmm. I sort of get to understand what's lacking. And you just have to use a program yourself to go,
oh, yeah.
I wish I did that. So you've already got that point of view there. But there's a fantastic moment in my life when I was doing this thing for a few years already and a guy called Dick Powell got in contact with me. Mm-hmm. I went, oh, Dick Powell. He's a guy from the UK. Now, I'm not sure if everybody in the States knows this guy. The DNAD is a UK institution for design. Mm-hmm. And they do the DNAD Pencil Awards, et cetera, et cetera. They're quite well known. There's quite a few US companies who've won them, et cetera.
Yep.
And he's now I think he's the chairman, or he was a chairman, definitely. And he also did a television program in the 90s with Mr. Seymour. Seymour Power is the name of their company. They did product design. And they did, and I remember this in the 90s, something called Channel 4 in the UK. They did a series, I went, that's not the same Dick Powell, surely, because he's one of the only designers I knew the name of. I'm not very good with names of designers. And he, is this the same guy who just got in contact with me? And he wanted to do something completely unrelated. And I said, look, look, lovely, the thing you want to do, can't do that, but can I come down and interview you? You know, can I bring a TV camera sort of thing along, professional guy, and I want to interview you. I said, yeah. I thought, this guy's crazy. Fantastic. Good. And I interviewed him, and it's still on YouTube. It's an awful thing still on YouTube with me as the worst interviewer whatsoever. But I asked him one question, and asked him one question very clearly. I said, do customers know what they want? And the rest of the interview was very plain, very bland, with me asking the most dumb questions on earth. At that point, he suddenly came to life. No! How can they know what they want? How can they ever know what they want? And it's like this guy suddenly, every one bit of his angst came out of that moment and said, no, 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 no. It's you. How can people know what they haven't seen yet? Or, you know, to paraphrase what you said, how can people know that? Mm-hmm. You have to present it to them. And he said it so passionately. That stuck with me so long. And it's very true. How can you present something and say, well, you know, here are the options of what you could have? Well, that's sort of impossible. You know, you have to present something which is completely new. You have to take a dive into the deep end and invent something completely different. And then people come back and either say, that's brilliant, or there'll be tumbleweed going by. One of the two. So you've got to try and guess it right.
Sure. When you are testing and developing your plugins, what sparks the genesis of, say, something like Phantasm?
Well, the Phantasm one was that sort of, I wanted to do something. Mm-hmm. Utterly was, I wanted to change a color. Why can't I do it? That was a very clear thing. And I'm still to this day amazed that nobody else, including Adobe, had not done that very logical step at the start to making live color adjustments with hue saturations, you know, contrast, brightness, etc. That struck me as being such a clear cut. In fact, at the start, I did ask Adobe, said, look, we're basically going to be copying Photoshop's UI and put it in Illustrator. Do you mind I do this? Because I thought, oh, they'll come. You know, this was like somebody in the background who didn't even have a company yet. And I said, do you mind? And they said, no, sure, go for it. And so I went for it. And that one was too obvious in my mind. Every other single one has not been obvious. So what starts something? Well, I've got utterly amazing colleagues who develop things. Mm-hmm. I'm not a software engineer, so sure. I don't know how to do that. We have four software engineers, and we have web developers, senior web developer on top of that, etc. It's quite a small team. And if you think of that, we've probably developed 10 times more tools in the same period of time as Adobe have. It's not a fair comparison. They have to keep the whole Illustrator going. But if you look at that, they have to be amazing, amazing colleagues to develop that sort of level of tool. And they come up with ideas as well, very much so. In fact, nowadays, it's a bit of a running joke when they say, what's the specification new project? And I will hold up a sticky note to the webcam and go, a bit like that. And they go, oh, okay, right. And they will go and do amazing things and come back with things. But at the start, I suppose I specified out, so it'll be by assumption, by just closing your eyes, what do you possibly want to do? And I think one of the most out there ones that we did was something called WidthScribe, where you get the variable stroke width technology in Illustrator, and you can embellish artwork just based on the varying the stroke widths of, you know, the thing you've designed in outline. And that one to me is still the most unique thing, because that's doing something you can't do anywhere else, absolutely anywhere else, vector or non-vector. And it isn't necessarily our biggest plugin by any means in terms of popularity, but to me, it's definitely the one with the greatest amount of potential, because everybody knows you can design by shape, by color, etc., form, you know, all the usual things. But by the stroke widths, is actually you can give much more feel to a shape, to a graphic form than you would ever imagine. And so that sort of thing, that's sort of out of the blue. Other things are more sort of, why can't I extend a path? Somebody will ask and we go, good point. Here's a tool.
Yeah.
So yeah.
When you're developing it, so I'm trying to figure out how to word this. So you've got like the plugin for dynamic corners and things like that. You know, you spend this time developing it, and then Adobe finally integrates dynamic corners into their program. How do you keep that plugin relevant? I mean, I will say I use the Astute version more than I use the Adobe version of it. But, you know, if I didn't know it existed, I don't know that it would be one I would seek out, since I can change corners natively in Adobe now.
Yeah. Oh, that's probably one of the most asked questions. I think most people expect me to be angry and say Adobe steal things. Most people expect me to say that. I have been a bit miffed in the past. I will not be too holding back on that. But let's face it, the company started off two things. It couldn't do a thing without the whole Adobe infrastructure. They're doing a lot of hard work, you know, just keeping Illustrator ticking over on the operating systems alone is hard enough work. I will never take that away from them. That's a massive amount of work. Secondly, the first product we did was a complete clone of how color adjustment takes place in Photoshop. Mm-hmm. I mean, I asked them initially and they said yes, but it wasn't original. This stuff, I mean, that's before the halftone stuff came in and all that. That's not original. That's me taking an idea and putting it into something else, which I don't mind. If you add something on top of an idea, I think that's good. I think that's competition. I think competition is exceedingly healthy and essential. Mm-hmm. Witness the death of freehand and perhaps the slowing down of Illustrator. Mm-hmm. Those two things didn't coincide, you know, by coincidence sort of thing. So Dynamic Corners is the first and most commonly referred to one. In fact, here's a little tip, pop pickers. That reference probably doesn't go in America. That's a British reference. When you go to Adobe Illustrator, you can look within Illustrator in the program and see it's made up of plugins itself.
Sure.
And you will know that the native Corners one is called Live Corners.
I think so.
I think it is.
Yeah.
Go into the native plugins folder and you'll find out it's called Dynamic Corners. The file name of the plugin is called Dynamic Corners, which to me, it still is to this day, and they've never renamed it. They've never used that terminology or that phrase before. Obviously, at some point internally, they went, no, we really can't call it Dynamic Corners because that's far too obvious. But the interesting thing is that when they did it, and this is why I don't mind too much, when they did Live Corners, they did a shortcut, a very, very obvious shortcut, which to us technically. And that was, if you try and put two corners together, so they touch mm-hmm. together, they never touch.
Right.
Okay. So if you imagine a long rectangle, you get the roundings on the corners, so you get mm-hmm. a lozenge shape, rounded rectangle thing, mm-hmm. and you round the edges off the rectangle so much so the corners touch, and you look at that shape, it has got 8 points on it. This is really nerdy. I will get nerdy very quickly. It should have 6.
Yeah, yeah.
You have got a rounded rectangle. You've got top ones on each corner. And then you've got the apexes off the corners on each end. These sort of 180-degree curves. Mm-hmm. So there should only be 6 points, but there are 8. They don't touch. To me, that says everything about how deep you should go in design. Ours touch. So ours only has 6 points. Now, you may think, what the heck does that do for people? What's the point? Well, internally, we know that they've done a cheap shortcut to be able to break those shapes apart and redo those corners, whereas we have a very complex mechanism internally to keep track of all the corners and allow you to modify them and do so much more with them. So you can select whole selections quite differently, join them together, do true roundings, da-da-da-da. Mm-hmm. All very technical. It's sort of, we could have done what they'd done in 10% of the effort that what we had expended. But we went that whole way because it gives you massive advantages a lot of the way down the line. That there's that finessing that we can do that they can't do. And that, I think, defines why I'm never that worried. Whenever we do something and Adobe sort of replicates it to a degree, and they don't really copy truly, mm-hmm. Then it's never quite to the same level. So a case in point is our Smart Point Remove technology.
Sure.
Get a brush over points, and it gets rid of them magically. It is magical. I'm still amazed how
Yeah.
Our amazing colleagues have done it. I don't know how to.
That's probably the one that I use the most.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's loved. It is utterly loved. And Adobe in Illustrator 2020 have done a new Simplify, which they said is their smart point remove. And they did say that in Adobe Max. Not necessarily that's paraphrasing. Everybody just realized, no, it isn't. Because again, they've done sort of some of the effort, but not gone all the way. And it's going all the way that really makes a difference. And that's why we coexist with Adobe.
Mm-hmm.
Because why they've got other things to think about as well. You know, we can specialize to such a level of nerdery that, you know, we'll make people happy. Whereas they may go, well, we'll do 10% of the work and 90% of the people will be satisfied.
Yeah.
Not necessarily happy, but satisfied. And so that will do. And it does, from a business point of view, that will do. And I can see why they do that. And we'll just take it that extra bit further. So our users are really the pro-end users, you know, the Von Glischkas, you know, the Aaron Draplins, etc. You know, they're very good friends and they use our software every day. And they use it because it does it to that level of detail that they were expecting of it.
Mm-hmm. I enjoy, I'm friends with both of them as well. And I enjoy Von ranting on Twitter about all of the Adobe problems that he has. It's so much fun to watch just the cranky old man come out in him.
Oh, I admire it. I wouldn't be surprised his house is flame-proofed. I love Von.
Yeah.
There is no limit. And, you know, and fair dues. If he pulled, you know, comments on our software, as I say, it wasn't good enough, I would want him to. If he didn't feel it was good enough, I would want him to say that. I do want people to say when things aren't good enough. Otherwise, things don't improve.
Yeah.
Von loves the snap to points thing at the moment. He's loved it for the last year or two.
That is, yeah.
But I think the important thing on the other side is that Adobe's mentality in the last few years has changed for the better. Mm-hmm. They are listening much more. There's a great guy called Anubhav, and he's the project manager of InDesign and Illustrator, you know, the overlord of InDesign and Illustrator,
mm-hmm.
Group together, product group. And he will go out of his way to listen to Von and respond to Von. You know, and you turn around, if you see all the things Von has posted, you think, oh my goodness, I'd have shunned him, you know, if I was upon it. You know, he's complaining about our software. How dare he?
Mm-hmm.
No, he goes out of his way and says, no, okay, tell us, Von, how it's a problem for you. Give us example files. And that shows a lot of commitment and a change in attitude that perhaps we haven't seen for the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really shown a good light on Adobe, to be fair to them.
Yes, I would agree with that. Von and I were at a conference, when was it? November, beginning of November together. And he mentioned that. So he's happy that they listen much more than they used to. They still could do better, but they are much better than they used to be.
Yes.
So,
they recognize they could do better as well.
Yeah.
So I think that's why they're focusing on quality a bit more. They're also increasing the release cycle, I've noticed.
Mm-hmm.
In the recent, I mean, we don't have much more inside information than anybody else, to be honest. So
sure.
There's no great conspiracy or there's no great secrets I can reveal, and I wouldn't want to anyway. That'd be business. But
yeah.
But, you know, I can see them upping the amount of releases per year, and a lot of them are concentrating on quality. That's good.
Mm-hmm. As Astute Graphic evolves and grows and, you know, you guys start looking for new products and new plugins and things like that, that you can at least talk about, what are some things that are on the horizon for you guys?
Well, we've recently changed a model in which we sell things.
Mm-hmm.
That's caused a bit of contention, for sure. And
sure.
I understand why. But that means we can also now show a bit more of a roadmap. So we're actually starting to say what our roadmap is a bit more, which we've never used to do. And I suppose what we can say is that we're starting to use more of the technology we've just spent years developing in the background. We spent the last 7 years developing vector technology in the background that a lot of it still isn't actually out there in the public domain.
Mm-hmm.
Now you think, well, why would we bother to do that? We do plugins. Well, we knew that there were certain elements of Illustrator we haven't got access to, and you know, we're not asking for that. We just, it's a bit proprietary, it's a bit too in-depth, and most plugin developers wouldn't want it. And so that's fair enough. So we thought, well, we'll start developing things. Things like Boolean, you know, that's the Pathfinder operations. Mm-hmm. Cool. So adding, subtracting, dividing shapes, etc. So we started doing that. And you start to get into the depth of those things, and you start to look at it and go, you know what? That took us 2 weeks to make Boolean operations, and then it took the other 9 months to make it work properly mm-hmm. in all scenarios. And this is an engineering team in the background working on this. We've got a fantastic experimental engineer as well who's done magic stuff on this. And, you know, as part of a team, but there's some real skills here. And then we went, okay, we've done the Boolean. We'll do path offset. Again, it didn't take that long to do the first one. A few weeks again to knock it up. And again, another sort of 9 months, a year to refine it and make it work in all scenarios. Again, I'm seeing a pattern here. Mm-hmm. It's easy to do a little bit and get it working for 90% of the artwork. Very, very hard to make a bit of software that works in everything. Because you as a designer, you will chuck anything. We love you for it, right? You'll come to a software package and say, why doesn't it do this? And you go, because it's mathematically really hard. I don't care, but it's my pretty design. I want it to work. Yeah. I get it. It has to work in every scenario. And so things like this. So you've got your offsetting of paths. You've got, well, a lovely one that's going to come out soon, and it's public, I think, are going to be the long shadows. We've got it in one way in Illustrator, but we're going to do it fully in Illustrator. Mm-hmm. So it's all live. And you think, oh, the long shadow isn't hard. Just do a blend. No, it doesn't work like that. Long shadow relies on two different massive underlying technologies. You can't just make a long shadow. And people don't understand that. So another one is a sketching tool, which I did a very quick preview of. You're getting a Wacom tablet, something like that, mm-hmm. sketching away. And we've got a thing called Dynamic Sketch, which has originally relied on Illustrator technology. More and more it's relying on our own. And now we've got our own variable stroke width technology, which is so much better. It's like this, it does everything. If you imagine a path that, you know, like a calligraphy pen can start at one angle and then end the path at another angle and still all be live. And it makes me excited to try this because suddenly an engineer gives me this and go, oh, wow. So all this thing is going to come. Now, we do have the roadmap. So we've got long shadows, live offsetting, including off an open path. So if you like, imagine mm-hmm. a little Wi-Fi symbol with a little quarter triangle. Mm-hmm. Quarter circle, sorry. Imagine offsetting that with a few clicks. It's like, No, you can't do that in Illustrator.
No, yeah.
You can't do it.
No, you kind of have to just draw it on your own and figure it out. Yeah, I've had to do that before. It's never fun.
That's it. But that's one tiny example. So all these things. So yeah, there's going to be creativity and productivity. But what I want it to be, what I find it personally, what I want people who use our software to find is that it's fun as well. Mm-hmm. I can suddenly do this sort of design. It's sort of this enthusiasm to see something suddenly appear for the first time that you couldn't do. And I've got stories of that, how I go to large companies, got one extremely large customer with lots of 100 designers, and I can go there and I will peer over their shoulders. And I remember that there's two examples, there's two very large companies I went into. One was in America mm-hmm. and one wasn't. And if I say where it is, it's too pinpointed, too easy. And the one in America, very large studio, and they did a movie poster. Mm-hmm. And I was in a meeting, and this is a few years ago, and it was a movie poster with a typical skyscraper scene. Skyscraper with a big dramatic action movie type thing.
Sure.
And I just demonstrated this width scribe tool where I showed how the widths went thinner and thinner as it went at the skyscraper in one drag. And the guy just turned around. He's a big, burly sort of a designer guy, really nice guy. You make me sick. That just took me 2 weeks, and you just showed me that in one click. I hate you. Sorry about that. And then another one, a fantastic, you know, very large brand T-shirt. This guy had done T-shirts. I'm quite a novice designer in a large company. Mm-hmm. And I said, just show me what you design. And he was so proud of the design. And he showed me for about 20 minutes. I did this. And it took me 2 days. And yeah, really, look at that. And there's a simple logo effect type mm-hmm. thing. And I went, yeah, you do realize you've got our plugins. He went, yeah. I said, click on that, yeah. Now click on that, yeah. And he just saw his face. And it just did this effect in about two clicks. And I said, yeah, you can change it like that. So it's a different effect. And he started crying a little bit and went, oh, that's, I feel really bad now. It literally 2 days of his life, you know, to perfect this thing. And I went, yeah, you can just do it in two clicks, mate. And that gets to one of my bees in the bonnet about try and learn a bit more what you've got you know, in front of you. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, that was, I was going to follow up and ask about that is, you know, because your plugins, I use them primarily for productivity. I know a lot of people who do, you know, things with, I mean, not that I don't do things with them that enhances the creativity, but it's the productivity portion of it that makes my life so much easier. when you're introducing these new things, people have to learn them. How are you, you know, and how are you motivating designers to learn new things, to keep up with things? Because a lot, going back to Von Glitchke, he has a term that I love where, you know, designers who don't improve, he calls them dinosaurs. And you know, I'm not going to lie, there's been times in my life where I've been guilty of that, of not, you know, keeping up enough because I just get in the habits and it's easy to use. And then, you know, when Adobe itself changes the way that you do things, it's, you know, everybody freaks out and is trying to remember how to do it, and you have to relearn something. So I've tried to be better at keeping in touch. But how are you guys, as a third party developer for these products, motivating people to learn how to use your tools to really buy into that?
Oh yeah, this is a big one. Now we're going to get back to the name of Dave Clayton here. Mm-hmm. So Dave Clayton, he's in charge of the training at Astute Graphics. His official title is training manager at Astute Graphics. And we use third-party content creators as well as internal content creation to create YouTube videos, Vimeo videos, etc., as well as using third-party, usually friends of Astute Graphics, in that they are initially customers and we reach out to them and they become more and more familiar with us. And they will create blog-based material for us, so written material. So we do all that, but we still got this huge problem, as every company who creates software and new tools does have. But I think it's inherent. There is something about the graphic design market or the visual design market, you know, to make it broader, that there's this problem of learning. Mm-hmm. A lot of people know how to use a pen tool in Illustrator because that pen tool has been adopted by other companies who are Illustrator Lite sort of programs. And I always go, why have you just copied the oldest tool on the market? Why did you pick a 30-year-old tool to copy the concepts of? That tool was created when there was very little hardware that could allow you to do really powerful things. So you're relying on 27 key presses using your nose and your toe to hold down your sufficient keys in order to make that thing happen. Why did you pick that concept? Anyway, so... But they're used to that. They're, you know, there's this sort of pen tool camaraderie out there, and people learn all these keyboard shortcuts, and there are lots of cheat sheets on how to draw shapes with the pen tool. Mm-hmm. And I despair at the pen tool. I really do. It's really hard going for a new person to come along to. In fact, we did experiments several years ago where I call it the Saunders leaf, because we had a colleague back then who had nothing to do with graphic design. And I gave her a challenge. I said, right, here's Illustrator. You've never used Illustrator, really. Can you draw me a leaf form using just 2 points and a pen tool? So the 2 points are two sharp points, and you got two curves connecting the two sharp points. Mm. Can you draw me that leaf? And never used Illustrator. So imagine imagine casting your mind back to the first time you opened Illustrator or a vector design program and discovering what a Bezier is. Mm-hmm. You click, and then sort of click and hold, click and drag, no, click, but then that point disappears. What's this handle thing? And, you know, this whole is fascinating, absolutely fascinating to watch a new designer trying to get to grips with what a Bezier curve is. And not only that, trying to get to grips with a 30-year-old concept tool in Illustrator with the, you know, huge amount of buttons all over the screen relatively. And, you know, this ain't working. So anyway, that person, you know, 20 minutes and then gave up. And we thought, I'm going to test more people. So tested experience designers, really experienced designers, right to novices. People had used Illustrator Basic. The average was around 20 minutes to give up. 10 minutes on relatively novice users who could somehow feel that, hang on, this is a leaf. Mm-hmm. This is 2 points, this is two curves. You took how long to make that? Why was it so complex? You know, why were there so many obstacles put in your way to make that simple shape? And that came back to the whole thing. Well, how do you teach somebody to make that shape? First of all, the software has to be much more intuitive.
Sure.
So we're moving much more now to having on-screen help. So in fact, we just launched a plugin recently as part of our new annual service plan to, it's called, hang on, at which point you're going to have to cut that out because what's it called again? It's called Astute Buddy. And it's a plugin that doesn't do anything apart from give you tips on what key you can press to do more. Mm-hmm. That's a little panel on the screen. That's all it does. And that actually is one of the most useful things we've ever done, as well as in dialogue boxes, there's more help there. So what does this do? Explain this a bit more in front of you on the screen. Beyond that, the YouTube videos, we are trying to push that all the time. We've got something called the Astute Manager, and that's destined to have training material in there. So knowing what you're using. So that's great. So you've got all these things, but you've still got this problem with the mentality of, in the design industry, the graphic design industry, of learning. There's a deficiency of it. Mm-hmm. People tend to know 8 or 10 tools in Illustrator.
That's about right, yeah.
Yeah. That's about one eighth of the tool set of Illustrator.
Probably.
And then those people also tend to go onto the internet and complain that Illustrator doesn't do X, Y, Z. And you're going, no, actually, it does. It's just that you haven't tried to discover the solution here. And so it's very hard to say to people, you're wrong, but they're wrong. They have to learn things. They have to be curious. And that's what I'm amazed why that doesn't happen in this market. If you look at the web development market, the web design market, the UI, UX market, you know, you've got all the Figma, XD, Sketch, obviously. They're sort of, they've been blossoming. In fact, that storm has now blown over. We've had that moment and it's gone now. So massive market. People have been really curious. Whole new work frames that web developers can suddenly, and they've got this curiosity to look at it and go, can they use it? And then a month later, no, something better's come out. Let's forget everything I learned for the last month. Let's go for this now. And they're continuously learning new material and really going at 100 miles an hour all the time. And the vector design market are going at about 5 miles an hour in terms of learning.
Do you think that comes from with products like Figma and Sketch and Adobe XD is they have such a quick iteration cycle that you have to constantly keep up? And when it comes to Illustrator, it's a much slower iteration cycle. So they're not like Figma and Sketch and especially XD it feels like it's rebuilt itself 3 or 4 times over in the past year and a half. And, you know, Adobe Illustrator doesn't really feel like it's ever rebuilt itself. It's just added on more crap. It just bogs you down. And I know for me, like half the time, I'm just like, well, I know how to do it in this. I don't need to figure out how to, you know, use the graph tool. I don't need that. Like I can, you know, I could, if I need to make a graph, and I'll be honest, as much as I hate Excel and things like that, I'll go into Excel, I'll build it, and then I'll take the output, bring it into Illustrator and just trace the damn thing. Cause it's that much quicker and that much more intuitive.
Yes. Oh, utterly right tools for right jobs, etc. And it's interesting what you say about XD. That has a massive cycle of development. Now, you have to also think the team behind XD is 10 times larger than Illustrator. Mm-hmm. So, literally, which is a bit strange. But you say that perhaps Illustrator hasn't reinvented itself enough. Here you've got a real problem for Adobe team, I can see. Mm. Firstly, you've got the people who want everything new. you know, let's rewrite Illustrator. If I see that written one more time, I will scream. Because why? Because there's a huge amount already that you haven't already discovered.
Sure.
The other thing is that if you do redesign it, people say, you've moved my tool.
Mm-hmm.
How dare you've moved my tool? And they can never pick the right tool to move, because there's always, you know, a group of people who will use some tool which everybody else thinks is obscure. Let's take the lens flare tool, which everybody ridicules.
I don't think I've ever used it once. No, I know it exists. Yeah. I've just never used it.
Everybody picks on it. I pick on it as well. But there must be somebody out there who uses the lens flare tool once a month. Mm-hmm. And if you moved it, they'll go, where's my lens flare tool?
Mm-hmm.
So this is the point. They made it. They tried to make it, for example, more, well, simplified, easier to use and more cuddly. When was it? In CC 2019, they removed half the tools from the toolbox, and you have to go and show advanced tools.
Yeah, that part I don't enjoy.
Yeah. But everybody went, what have you done? Well, now, hang on, they've just tried to simplify it and make it easier for novices.
Yeah.
And suddenly you've got a massive backlash. Well, now you've got the two camps fighting it out. We're novices, or we use Illustrator lightly, and we, you know, go into it once a month, and we want to be really friendly with it.
Mm.
We don't want to learn everything. And you've got the other lot who are, you know, perhaps more our end, who are the pro end, who go, we use it every single minute of every single day. You move that tool one more time, I'm going to make another tweet. And I don't blame either camp.
No.
Both camps are right. So you've got this split personality, and you've got a big problem with Illustrator that's been around for 30 years, which is really unusual. And it's got so much stuff in it already. What do people actually want? So this is the interesting thing. People want it to reinvent itself. Reinvent itself to what? That has never been answered. Oh, I want you to join Illustrator, InDesign, and Photoshop together. That's another classic one.
Yeah. Please. No, I do not.
Never do that.
I am firmly in the camp of no, I do not, because it's the that to me goes back to the marketing saying of when you try to be everything for everyone, you're nothing to it. You end up being nothing. It's because it's just you need specialization. There is a reason that things break out, and it's okay to have a feature or two from one of those programs in the other program, you know, for simplifying workflow, but when you try that program would be just so bloated, and just your computer would never run.
the user's minds would just explode. I wouldn't cope with it. I know most people wouldn't cope with it. Just it's too much of a good thing. Now, interestingly, there's Affinity, which has come on the market in the last 5 or so years, and they've got this sort of split personality method where one program can merge into another, etc. To the artwork to fairly transparently go between pixel to vector to layout, etc. Now, but you have a sort of very good fundamental framework of that in Illustrator as well, with linked artwork. That sort of ideology has been around many, many years as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there are pros and cons with each single one.
Sure.
Affinity is... it's quite an interesting one. We have a lot of people saying, oh, why don't you do plugins for Affinity Designer? Well, they don't do plugins yet. It's not yet mature enough. And this comes into an interesting point. If you're a professional designer, why is the whole Creative Suite too expensive? I get this a lot. You know,
yeah, I don't understand that.
But the backlash is still going on.
Yeah.
Was it 2011 and we're in 2020 now? Oh, 9 years later? Yeah. If you're still on CS6 because you refuse to go up to a Creative Cloud with Adobe,
because it's got a monthly payment. Yeah.
I understand in different parts of the market, you know, people may want to use certain programs all the time. I get that. So we're talking about people who make a living out of these programs. Mm-hmm. That's if you're a hobbyist, I get it. If you're in different regions of the world, Adobe do different pricing. So we pay more in the West than in certain areas. So I get that. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. But if you think that because you've paid £30 or let's say $30, $40 for Affinity, one-off, that you've cheated the whole system and you're going to win because the other mugs are paying $60 a month or whatever for the whole Creative Suite, I'm sorry. It's a bit like a plumber or an electrician saying, you know what? I don't need to hire a van every day. I'm going to walk around with a wheelbarrow and all my tools in the wheelbarrow because it's cheaper. Look, those fools are paying $200 a month for a van and I'm going around with a wheelbarrow. I've saved it. I'm therefore cleverer. No, you've just lost all your work because it's taking you so much longer to get from place to place to place.
Sure.
And that's the same in here. You've got 20 massive applications at least. And what can't you do with all that stuff together?
Yeah.
It may crash a bit. So does Affinity. So does every program. They crash every so often. It's unlucky. Save your work frequently. That gets out of that one. But it's sort of, you know, if you're a professional, they will do everything you need.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't really a secondary option, in my opinion.
Well, yeah. And when, you know, I think the benefit of when they moved over to that type of life cycle or, excuse me, payment structure is that you now don't have to go buy a full new license every time they come up with a new thing. You're still just paying the monthly rate that you did. And they've reiterated and they've come out with a new version and, you know, it's there for you to use. You don't have to buy it again. And that's why people held on to the CS6 and their CS3 and CS4 and all that stuff for so long, is because they didn't want to have to drop down $600, $1,000, you know, a year after they bought the previous version. Well, now, I mean, yes, you end up paying about the same amount, really, but they're able to pump out updates and things like that, and you don't have to worry about rebuying software.
Absolutely. A case in point is Audition.
Mm-hmm.
Audition comes with the whole Creator Suite, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
I would never have bought Audition.
Yeah.
It's audio. What the heck do I need Audition? But now we're doing more and more audio-based stuff for training, etc. Audition is an essential part.
Mm-hmm.
But I probably wouldn't have looked at it. I've probably gone, oh, Audacity is free. And there you get the problem again. Audacity is free, but it doesn't do what Audition does, in my opinion. Others may vary. Obviously, everybody's mileage may vary. And there's lots of programs in there that just go, oh, that's good. Well, like Premiere. Well, we could do more editing in Premiere. You know, all these things. And like you say, keeping current, because Apple are now releasing on a yearly cycle on their operating system. If you cast your mind back before, Apple did that on a longer cycle and they charged you for the operating system. So people didn't pay for the operating system upgrades as frequently. They'd stay on behind one or two iterations, but now it's free.
Yep.
This is a curse for software developers because everybody just goes, yeah, I'll upgrade that. Bang, big button, and it upgrades your system. And then the next comment is, my system doesn't work. Don't upgrade it so quickly. Give it a month. Give it a month. Work out if your system will explode first.
Yes.
I've been guilty of it. So
I'm guilty of it. I still haven't updated to the newest OS. I'm still on Mojave.
Yes.
So I need to at this point, but also, it's working fine for me. So, you know, I generally wait a good 6 months or so before I update operating systems. And that's because it gives me time for all the programs that I use to generally update. And I check to see, you know, which ones I use haven't updated. And if it's going to seriously affect my workflow, then, you know, I'll wait.
Oh, you're wise. You're wise beyond your years, sir.
I don't know if I'm wise beyond my years. I've just learned my lesson enough times.
I mean, we've got the privilege now. Obviously, we've got quite a few machines surrounded, so we can check with certain machines and we can upgrade them, obviously, and use virtual machines now as well. That's obviously a godsend over the last, you know, 5 more years where they become powerful enough and reliable enough. So we do all that stuff, and obviously, but I'm still on Mojave, personally. Because there's other software I use that, you know, breaks. And this is the thing. I mean, we've gone to an annual service plan, which is almost like software as a service, but it isn't quite. It's where if you stop paying, you'll get to keep your licenses at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, if Adobe Illustrator upgrades and breaks your licenses, you've got to join up again.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically you don't get licenses free forever, which is partly with the route we were starting to go down. We kept on handing out free licenses, and this was financially untenable. You couldn't do it forever.
Sure.
There's, for example, people who had bought Inkscribe right at the start, one of the plugins, 8 years ago, we're still getting free upgrades for Inkscribe because there was never a version 2 of Inkscribe. We've did major, major minor updates, if that makes any sense. But we never did it. So we never charged. And you go, we can't do this forever. We had actually been trying to be quite as generous as possible, but it got to the point, it got impossible. So we've got to make the change as well because there's so many changes externally. It's getting impossible also from a customer's point of view. What version do I have? Which one did I buy? There's 16 products I've bought. Or, you know, I bought 3 out of the 16 products. Which one is the latest? Can I have an upgrade path for this one or this one? Can this one work with this one? And it's like, it got so complex for customers and for us to support it that we went, we've got to rewrite how we do this. It just is untenable over the years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we made a massive change and we did it. In a way, I regret it, and in a way, I don't regret it. Quite brutally, we changed over quite a quick cycle because we knew the answer would have been from many people, I don't want a subscription-based service.
Sure.
We knew that would happen. So then we looked around and we saw Sketch's model. This was actually quite late in the day. And we saw how they did it. They do what we call the annual service plan, where you buy it. For a year, you get free upgrades. At the end of the year, you can keep what you got.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you want to keep going, you get the free upgrades again. So it's a fantastic thing for a company to have to prove itself in that year to warrant requesting, you know, politely, do you want to pay for another year? Because if you've done badly in that year, people will rightfully go, forget it.
Yeah.
I don't need another year of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm out. So we're actually now developing that twice the rate because, and this is the interesting bit, it's so much easier for us to pump stuff out to everybody who's on the plan. It was so complex to accommodate the old model that it actually took the engineering team half the time to accommodate it largely to a degree. And now it's like, well, you've either got everything or you haven't got it. So easy. So easy. So people are either on the bandwagon or they're not on the bandwagon. And I understand why people begrudge. I really, really do. I understand why they would be upset with us. I genuinely understand that. But I also would suggest it's a business decision at the end of the day. If you're a professional, you've got to look at this. It was $119 we charge a year. You've got to look and go, will that save me time? Will I make that money back?
Well, yeah. Say you bill $120 an hour for your stuff. If it saves you, you know, more than an hour a year, you've already made your money back. I know for me, it probably saves me more than an hour a week on doing stuff. So I'm making my money back well over. So thank you very much for that. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
But you know,
it's great. It's great to hear that. It's great to hear it.
Yeah. I mean, well, like I said earlier, for me, it's the productivity factor of it makes things so much easier for me to be able to do that. Real quick. We started to touch on the, you know, keeping up to date and learning things, and we got off on a tangent. I want to get back to that. And what are you looking to focus on when it comes to helping designers keep learning and not getting dated themselves? That continuous education, because there aren't any continuing ed programs really for designers. Whereas, you know, if you're a doctor or a lawyer or somebody like this, you've got continuing ed hours that you've got to take to keep up and keep your licenses. There's nothing like that for us, which good, because I don't have to pay for that. But, you know, we definitely need to be keeping up. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. No, my fault. Are you a member of LinkedIn Learning?
No, I'm not, actually.
I would recommend that as a starting point for all designers.
Sure.
It's a curated resource. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the most important things. There's a vast amount on YouTube. Don't get me wrong. There's actually good stuff to learn on YouTube.
Yeah.
There's also very bad stuff to learn on YouTube. There's videos we've looked at and gone, you've just demonstrated it. How?
Sure.
Oh my goodness, that's taken 20 times longer and it's now destructive and whatever. But on LinkedIn, no, you get the professionals in, you get the true, well, I mean, Von Glischer is obviously one of the top illustrator designers on LinkedIn Learning. And Tony Harmer, the design ninja, very good, all very good friends. And these people have honed their craft for years and years and years, and they're giving you absolute gems of knowledge, absolute gems of knowledge. And there's a vast amount to keep on learning. So, for example, what we did for a while, and we're going to come back to it, is the 10-minute skills.
Mm-hmm.
10 minutes every day to try out something you've never done before. What is 10 minutes?
Yeah.
If somebody turns around and said, I haven't got 10 minutes, I say, you've lost your 10 minutes already because you're now working so inefficiently. And we see this with large companies as well as freelancers. It isn't, in fact, freelancers tend to be more cutting edge, to be honest,
mm-hmm.
because people don't allocate time for training mm-hmm. in companies.
No, they do not.
Freelancers, so.
Yeah.
No. And
up until this past year, actually up until October of this past year, I'd worked in house for close to 20 years. And I was certainly behind on things. You know, the things I learned is because I wanted to go out and learn them. It wasn't because I needed to. It was because I was interested in something or figuring something out or that. So it was definitely self-motivation. And I mean, I think no matter what you do, you've got to have that in you. But, you know, like you were saying with the 10-minute things, when I started looking at those with the YouTube stuff that you guys had done, it was because I would hit either a creative block on something and I just needed a break. And, you know, I worked in a company, so it's not like I could just, you know, get up from my desk and go wander around and things like that, or, you know, do that more than once a day. And they tend to frown on it. So I would take that time to look at those videos and try to learn something, or, you know, do a quick Skillshare class or something like that. But now that I'm, you know, freelance, now that my wife and I are freelancing, you know, it's become much more imperative for me to have to keep up with things to be relevant when I am going out and talking to clients. Is I've got to know that. I can't afford to sub that out to somebody half the time. It's, you know, so I've got to keep on track with things.
I think that is a very, very intelligent approach. And it's strange, like I say, more the freelance side or the small agencies tend to be more with that mentality mm-hmm. that they feel that to be at the cutting edge, they have to really learn stuff. And that I 100% endorse. And it's strange how the larger organizations, it's not all, there are good ones. Why isn't there time allocated for training? Genuine time allocated for training. Now, okay, internally in Astute Graphics, there are 12 of us at the moment. We're not a large organization.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a policy that 1 in 10 working days is allocated to training. Now, okay, let's be realistic. When there are peak times, that goes out the window because we're all too busy and we forget we're meant to be training. And, you know, there are some months where that never happens. But the official thing is still there. And I really, really try and push that where I can. Now, it's hard in some areas, it's hard to do official training. And for the benefit or for the audience, I did air quotes, which I really shouldn't because that makes me look so 90s.
I do the but same thing.
But when you get to the official training, it's sort of, if the training involves you looking at a Skillshare or a LinkedIn learning course, or there are obviously specialist ones for like web developers, et cetera, et cetera. If you are just looking at a course for a day and you may be looking at it from home, and you have to be accepting that the employer's or the employee is not in, they're at home, they're looking at the internet, you know, for videos all day. And I know there are managers who frown at that and go, well, they're obviously not working. Well, yeah, if they can, you know, show and implement how they're putting it in, they wouldn't be cheating themselves if they didn't put it in. We've got an astonishing team, and I would never question whether they would actually, you know, go home and just look at Netflix all day. That isn't the point.
Yeah.
They would. They would go home and learn because they know it's a benefit to themselves as well for their skill portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And going to an event is another way of learning. In fact, you probably will learn more in, say, 3 or 4 days at Adobe Max. And I'm looking forward to, I'm going to go to Creative South for the first time.
Oh, good.
In 2 months. Why not? I hear it's a party.
It is. It's a lot of fun.
Well, it is. It's fun. And you would, but you know, something like Creative South, you've got Crop, which is becoming popular as mm-hmm. well now. That's really coming on the radar for me. You've got the How Design shows, which I've been to in the past. just sitting down and looking at a session for an hour, I'll learn more than just looking at online for like 5 hours. I go, oh, that's quite a neat trick. I like that. I'll go and try and implement that. So, you know, there is a vast amount to learn out there, but it isn't, like you say, it isn't a structured one where you're a lawyer or a doctor, where if you don't learn it, you're out of the practice because you're no longer legal. In this case, you know, it's up to the person to actually try and get off their own backside and actually do it. And I think it's an important question for anybody who's about to start a job with an organization as a designer, as a creative in some form. Mm-hmm. One of the questions you should ask, and I'm amazed when people come here to be interviewed, the percentage of people who don't have questions ready about what they're going to do. One of our first questions, if you're going to get a job with us, right, here's a little tip. The first question is going to be, what does Astute Graphics do? And the first person who answers again, oh, you're a graphic design agency. We go, well, that's a nice interview. Thank you. Next.
Yeah.
you haven't spent 2 seconds researching.
No.
So it's the same question. So have your questions ready. And one of the most important questions should be, what training are you going to offer me? How are you going to improve me? Mm-hmm. And if the result is, well, that's what you're doing in your own time, mate, I'll go, no, you're just going to drain me, ring me out, throw me away in 2 years' time, get another designer who spent all their free time learning and da da da. Now, that's not to say you shouldn't spend some of your spare time learning. If you are serious, if you're a professional, you should enjoy it. You should do it. Listen to a podcast. I can think of one right in front of me now. You should listen to it. So do that, but you've got to ask, where is my training? You're taking all the skills from me. What are you giving back? That's really, really, really important. If a potential employer says there is no training policy, or there isn't anything, or you can do it in your lunch break, just say, well, perhaps I've got another offer. Thank you very much. Goodbye. Mm. I would really recommend that.
Yeah, I would too. That's when before I decided to go full-time freelance, when I was interviewing with other companies, that was one of the questions that was important to me, because I knew it's difficult to do when you've got a full-time job and you've got a family and things like that. It's difficult to find that time. So if the company promotes it and wants you to keep learning, you know, they obviously hopefully understand your value. Because I literally just saw this yesterday. It was a Richard Branson quote. It was, and I'm going to butcher it, but it was essentially, you know, companies need to invest enough time in teaching their employees so that they are able to leave, but value them enough so that they don't want to leave.
Oh, can I write that down?
Yeah.
that's a very good one. Yeah, you have to value. I've listened to several other sort of leaders talk. I'm not the greatest person in following the latest trends. I'm not with that, but
neither am I.
I am. No, but you do get these occasional glimpses and quotes and all that. And it is very true. You've got to say thank you as well. I'm adamant that, you know, I've got to say thank you to the amazing, I've got astonishing colleagues around me. I genuinely have. You know, if I had time to give a shout out to every single one, I do. I would. And from the engineering side, which I mentioned, training side, which I've also mentioned, the marketing side, who you say, oh, marketing is always a classic one with design. You know, there's this sort of friction sometimes. It should work hand in hand. And we've got a fantastic duo here. Camilla, who's our head of marketing and communications, and we have Kim, who's our website designer, and they work as a fantastic team together. That proves it can work absolutely brilliantly and should. And support as well, and we have Lorna, who looks after support. So if you write an inquiry to us, a technical inquiry, you probably get a response from Lorna or Carlos. Carlos, who does more of the technical inquiries, Lorna, who looks after accounts, etc., and Lorna's a support coordinator. And they both, you know, do amazing things. You know, even on the most, what people would say, oh, well, how can you train on basic things on answering an email? Well, yes, you can. You know, things progress all the time, and you have to learn with that side. But you also got to say, you know, thank you when you've done a brilliant job. And I'm saying thank you every day, I hope, because they are all doing brilliant jobs every day. it's got to go hand in hand. So you're right. You've got to try and say, well, here's a great environment to work as well. And we think we have. Well, I think I have in my delusional mind. Don't ask them. Please don't. I don't want to cry.
I understand. As we're getting kind of close to our time, I want to wrap up with a few rapid fire questions to get the feasting portion of the podcast in. And these just kind of answer them with the first thing that comes to your mind. It's three questions. It's not tough. The only thing is you can't have the same answer for the following questions. So the first one is, what's kind of like your earliest food memory? It could be, you know, making cookies with grandma or, you know, eating something. It doesn't have to be positive. Like one of mine is, I just blanked on it. It's something my mom used to make that I just absolutely despised, but it sticks in my memory all the time of anytime I hear it. It's essentially a Danish version of meatloaf that just it's not tasty. So what is your earliest food memory?
Spinach straight away. I had a fantastic mum. Sadly, she's not with us for quite a few years now, but she had an allotment in the back garden, and I'd used to try and drive my radio control cars over the cabbages because I hate cabbages. And I'd like other vegetables, but there was one thing which I remember when I was very young, to about the age of four, I like spinach. My mum would grow the spinach in the garden and then boil it and stick it on the plate. That's what you do. And one day, boiled it, stuck on the plate, and right in front of me was a caterpillar.
Oh.
And my mum just went, oh, sorry about that. Just picked up the caterpillar and said, right, eat the rest. And I couldn't eat, and I still can't eat spinach. Oh, I hate spinach.
No, I couldn't either. That would.
So, yeah, first food memory. But my mum cooked beautifully, and she, you know, it's one of those ideal sort of childhoods, absolutely ideal childhood. But I always remember that one.
Yeah, that would stick with me. That would, boiled caterpillar doesn't sound tasty to go with the spinach. What is your... what's kind of your go-to comfort food when you've had just a crap day and you just kind of want to veg out? And
oh, where do I give a list now? Actually, I have to confess, everybody knows me, is probably waiting when we put this brand name in it. Actually, it's more recently, I go to a local coffee shop. Everybody's going, oh, he's going to say coffee number one. Yes, I'm going to say coffee number one. I go to a local coffee shop and I now have a coffee rather than a food. So I'm winging it a little bit here. And I go there because I have 1 hour off. I now even read a paper. Remember those old things? They used to chop down trees and put ink on them.
Yeah.
I read a paper. I never did that before. I would say I have my pipe and slippers. That would suit me, but I don't have that. And I literally sit there with a coffee, and I hate coffee. I hate coffee, but I have one of those sort of mockers or whatever.
Sure.
So basically, I'm drinking a lump of sugar that has passed a coffee machine and looks like an adult drink, but is no way an adult drink. But I look sophisticated that way.
Hey, I enjoy those drinks too. I completely understand.
So there you go. It is a coffee.
Okay. And then what is your death row meal? That last meal you can ever have?
That last meal. I'll go back to my mum, to be fair to my mum. It's, I have to say, it's one of the many fantastic meals of my wonderful wife, also Susan. She has got a name. She's a lovely name. And she cooks some wonderful, and my fantastic son as well. Let's give him a shout out, Adam. He loves everything as well that his mum creates. And so I've got to say, well, there's too many selections to actually choose from. They're all too good. Does that get me out of the hole there? But I'll go back to something because I can't tend to have it now because I don't want to burn the house down. My parents are from Holland. I mean, they lived in England. I'm born in England, but my parents are originally from Holland. And my mum made every New Year's Day olieboller, which are roughly translated oil balls. If you imagine pancake batter, you stick it in deep fryer as a ball, and it goes crispy on the outside, lovely and sort of gooey, but sort of stretchy on the inside. Nicest thing on earth. But I've got this Oh, by the way, are your parents Danish?
No, my Danish descent. My great grandparents came over, so I'm second generation. But we still have connections to family in Denmark. My parents actually went over and saw, I don't know what, second cousin twice removed or something like that. Last year they went over to Denmark and visited with them. So the Danish culture is still well and alive within my family.
Oh, it is. We went there for the first time ever last year, and on the second day I wanted to emigrate there.
Yeah,
it's the most beautiful country. Mm-hmm. But the food is also quite similar to Holland. They're quite, obviously there's a lot of fishing going on. There's a lot of solid food. It's very sensible food.
It's not
very healthy food.
No frills is how I would put it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a lot of Northern European food is like that. Mm-hmm. That German food, Scandinavian food in general, English food. Mm-hmm. And it's that sort of thing. And Ole Bolle is like that. It will kill you with an artery attack on your second one.
Sure.
But it's that beautiful. But I can't make it because I don't like deep fat frying because I've got just visions of the house burning down. So that's what I miss. And that's what I can't get easy. You can't go to the local shop here and get it. It has to be fresh. I'd have to go to Holland or Nederland, if you want the full proper one, on New Year's Day and actually get it from a street vendor there. But that's not going to happen so quickly. So yeah, I suppose it's that one. And that would also make my life a bit longer because somebody would have to go to Holland and get some Ole Bolle on New Year's Day before they can turn the switch on to electrocute me.
Yeah, so see, there you go. Good way to extend your life. Well, Nick, where can people find you online?
Okay, well, Astute Graphics is the proper place to find what I do. So astutegraphics.com. For personal, I have literally New Year's resolution 2020. I started up a Twitter and an Instagram account, and there's nothing useful on it, but you can find me by eBayek, which if you're northern in England, you'll get it. If you're not northern in England, sorry about that. So you try and find a name that's unique. So that's Twitter and Instagram, and there's nothing useful on it apart from stupid pictures so far, as what everybody does. But I would say the best place is astutegraphics.com and all the Astute Graphics social things, such as the Twitter, which is Astute Graphics, YouTube, which is Astute Graphics, Instagram, which is Astute Graphics. So that's where you find us properly, and that's where you'll find me personally as well, whereas I post personal material around the company on there as well. So
we'll link to all that in the show notes as well, so people can find it a little easier. So Nick, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you, Jay. Yeah, it was fantastic. Thank you. I look at the sound waves of the recording and it's all me. I apologize to everybody for their eardrums. Thank you very much for your time, though, Jason. It's really appreciated.
You're welcome. And go out and break some bread.
Will do.
You can find out more about Nick on Twitter at eBayek, and be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with him. I hope you liked this episode of Feasting on Design. Let me know what you think. And if you like it, leave me a review over on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Visit feastingondesign.com to catch up on the archives of the Creative South podcast. Get some cool swag like t-shirts and stickers that are on sale right now for 50% off with free shipping on orders over $25 when you use the code FREESHIPPING, all one word. Plus, you can keep up with the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Feast on Design, and I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram. Or over on my website, ildisdesign.com.